folks, and welcome to Christ in Every Word, a podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute, housed on the beautiful campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest the sacred scriptures with me, Dr. Brian Gurman, assistant professor of theology here at the university, and director of the Concordia Bible Institute. Is there anything new under the sun? There is nothing better for you to do than to eat, drink, and find enjoyment in your work. These are some of the things we've been chewing on throughout our study of Ecclesiastes. Hope you've enjoyed it so far. Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the gatherer, the assembler. It's been a fun ride. If you forget everything else, remember this. This is not some sort of book of just some sort of cynicism or a depressed man just running his mouth for a while. Ecclesiastes has some profound content. I think it's quite fascinating. New Testament and Old Testament alike, you can find it in this book, I'm convinced. The testimony to the person and work of Jesus Christ as well, you can find in this book, I'm convinced, and does that in some fascinating ways. So anyway, welcome again to our study of Ecclesiastes. You can probably tell we're going to be focusing in on chapter 7, probably not the whole thing, just seeing 29 verses here. It's going to be beefy. I might end up just focusing on the first and last part. But anyway, that means we are skipping over just one chapter. Last time was chapter 5. I'm skipping over 6. Why am I doing that? Well, in some ways, it's chapter 6 continues the problem of wealth. If you tuned in last time, you heard me on chapter 5. Plenty to say there. I'm not going to kind of repeat some of the... It's a theme, the problems of wealth in Ecclesiastes. So I'm going to jump over that, leapfrog to number 7. Now, with that said, I mean, I guess the question does come up, why is so much on wealth in the Bible? Again, that's something I think I talked about a little bit last time, at least. Why do we need to hear this again and again and again? Well, maybe we need to talk about this and remind ourselves the dangers of wealth again and again and again, that sort of thing. So it's another example of that, I think, even in this book. With that said, we're going to talk about, the nature of the good life, I guess you could say. And that'll be with chapter 7 here. So I'll go ahead and jump into the text. We'll read it, and we'll go from there. Ecclesiastes 7 reads as follows. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the bosom of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evildoing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things, and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I find something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Alrighty, so there you have the text of Ecclesiastes 7. Well, you can tell there's a lot in there. Like I said, 29 verses. I might just end up focusing on the first and the last part of this. The first part of this sounds a lot like, you may have heard, the book of Proverbs. I mean, the first 13, 14 verses is basically, this shows the difference throughout the book. We have autobiography, we have the narrative, we have a parable, we have all these different things. Now we have the form of the proverb. And that's what's going to, but not just any old proverbs. That's what makes this so great, is that so many of these are echoes, if I can put it that way, allusions, that sort of thing, to traditional proverbial wisdom, the kind of stuff that you'll pick up in the book of Proverbs. But so often Qohelet will grab that proverb and quote like the first half of it or something. He just assumes his audience knows how it's going to end, and then he'll flip it on its head or deconstruct. He'll quote, like, if it's two parts, A and B, he'll quote A, oh, I know where he's going with this, and then flip it when he quotes B. B will deconstruct A and things like that. So it starts off a lot like Proverbs, but then he gives it all kinds of ironic twists and turns, which is, I think, what makes it so fun. I mean, part of the guy's job was sitting and weighing and arranging and comparing and compiling and sifting through and how to hear one proverb in light of another. He arranged these. He did this sort of compiling all the time. I was just amazed. I was at a study of Luke's prologue, the Gospel of Luke, first verse of Gospel of Luke. I was amazed when I saw this. I thought of our podcast series together. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to literally put their hand toward compiling, arranging a narrative of the things that have happened, the things that have been accomplished or fulfilled before us, the things that Jesus did, his person and work. Many have, my sense there with Luke, and also you see this at the end of John, is that many were trying to arrange, compile, assemble a sort of coherent, certain narrative of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, but weren't doing a very good job of it. And so also, then we get these things like, you know, John would say, well, hey, we could write on, many other things could be written. In fact, the world itself wouldn't even be able to contain the books that would be written. But these things have been written so that you have certainty about who Jesus is and believe in his name, and so on. So Luke, beginning of Luke, end of John are very similar. Now, what does this have to do with Ecclesiastes? Well, in my mind, it's a very similar thing. We're the best wisdom teachers. We're not dealing with the Gospels, so the apostles, the best apostles are the ones that are just like the apostles. Yeah, come on now. Here we go. Podcast. Just like the apostles, arranging, compiling, some doing a better job than others, apparently, so also the wise sage, the wisdom teachers, arranging, compiling, moving things together, some doing a much better job than others. What gives Ecclesiastes its brilliance is the way that Qohelet arranges and compiles things together. The combustion of the parts, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. It's the way that Qohelet arranges and compiles differing sources of wisdom and truth and puts them together. Say, what about this in light of that? Or how does this fit with that? and the product of which is just this the beautiful book of Ecclesiastes. So that, but I guess what puts that on display is chapter 7. A good name is better than precious ointment. Oh, don't you want a good reputation? Because as Proverbs would say, you know, 1,000 words, you've built up a good rep, but then one little word can crash it all down to a miserable halt, and you'll never get it back. One little fall, you know, you have people, oh, he's a good guy. I can't believe it. One little thing, oh, my goodness, and it comes with crashing all. So Kohelet starts out by saying, hey, a good name's great, isn't it? And he says, and the day of death better than the day of birth. What are we doing here? Oh, good reputation. And by the way, it's better to die than live. Now, wait a second. What are we doing here? Well, so this is kind of like a kind of vibrant example of how he operates here. It is better, I'm just the second verse as well, it is better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting. Now, what you just told us, that it's better to find enjoyment in your toil. And here he goes, sorrow is better than laughter. And now you're thinking, well, aren't we supposed to find enjoyment in things? And how is it now he's flipping it all on. So a few things to say here. The first thing is that, as we saw before, Kohelet doesn't even want us to get on top of his own wisdom. The moment he makes a discovery about eat, drink, and find enjoyment in your toil and why that's really kind of profoundly wise, he wants to go at it again and say, well, what about this and what about that? So, A, the first thing is just the kind of the way that he works, which is quite fascinating. B, the second thing, you take conventional wisdom, Proverbs, as people know it, and you state the exact opposite and ask if there's any truth in that. It's just a kind of profound, like, you just walk in front of I can't imagine you go in front of your kids, or I walk in front of my class, and I look at the students, I say, the late bird gets the worm. What do you think? Kohelet's the type of guy that says, is there a sense in which that's true? And he can't wait to find it out, because if that's the case, then the very opposite of conventional wisdom is the case. Is there a sense in which the late bird gets the worm? Well, every once in a while, something happens where, oh, we just brought out a fresh this or that. You just came right in time for the that or this. Wow, the late bird does get the worm. And Kohelet hops all over that and says, see, there's a sense in which the exact opposite of what you're claiming is wise, there's actually wisdom in the exact opposite. So what are you going to do with that? That's B. C, the other thing that's just fascinating about this is that there's a wisdom in turning things on its opposite that really shows forth what the nature of God's character is all about. What do I mean by that? Well, let's take this verse 3 again. Sorrow is better than laughter. Well, didn't you just tell us to find enjoyment in our toil? That's what we're working for, right? Isn't it purpose and meaning and vocation and God's plan and all these things? So this first thing, sorrow is better than laughter, it echoes Proverbs 14. But then he bats it around a little bit and says, well, if everything is going to end, if the laughter is going to eventually come to an end, or if the end of laughter is suffering or grief, then why don't we start with the opposite? You know, instead of laughter, why don't we start with suffering? Because then you can only go up. You know, let's have the lowest possible expectations so that we'll always be pleasantly surprised. Now, on the surface level, it's like, well, you're just being pessimistic. And yet at the same time, and by the way, this is not trying to just contradict these things. This is what... So what drives me nuts about some of these modern commentators, well, now he's contradicting. The word itself, I have a problem with contradicting his own refrain throughout the book of enjoying work. He's contradicting Proverbs. He's juxtaposing them. He's working with tensions. He's putting parts next to each other and asks, what's the effect of the whole instead of the sum of the parts, as I say. And I think in this case, it's quite profound. It's not just being pessimistic about, well, always view the glass as empty because then you can only go up. There's actually quite something quite profound in the way that he's thinking these things through, traditional wisdom. It doesn't sound all that dissimilar from someone. This sorrow is better than laughter. It does not sound all that dissimilar on my ears than someone who would come along and say, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. There is some sort, we would call this theology of the cross. We would call these all sorts of things. Blessed are those who mourn, because in your mourning you are participating in my own mourning over sin, death, and the destruction of the devil. Just like I cried outside of Lazarus's tomb, I feel that pain, but I promise you, when you're with me, the sorrow will be turned into joy. It may tarry for the night, but joy will certainly come in the morning. So yeah, Paul talks about this is the Apostle Paul. As sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as those who have been forsaken, yet always in the Lord's presence. Just this is 2 Corinthians. This is some BC stuff. This is not just some old, dead, ancient Near Eastern literature about somebody's sage career going off the rails. This is all about a profound kind of, I think this is like the theology of the cross of the Old Testament. This is the way that the Lord works upon us. It's a dying and rising. It's a putting to death. It's a bringing forth of a new man. It's the kind of sorrow that comes in being convicted by the Lord's words about his law, what he wants for us, and how far we've fallen from that, and also from his gospel, of course, and how much he has done to save us from that. So yeah, sorrow in that sense is better than laughter, in that sorrow must come first, and even, you know, sometimes tarry for the night, as the psalm would put it, but joy will certainly come in the morning. And in that sense, boy, that's the gospel in a nutshell. So yeah, sorrow is much better than laughter. For by sadness of face, when you recognize the sin and repent, the heart is certainly made glad. That's verse 3. I just think this is just awesome. I love the book. I'm sold. I'm going to have to recommend it to others. I've decided. There you have it. Boy, I've got to take a break. I'll talk to you real soon.
We'll be back in just a moment to the Concordia Bible Institute podcast. In the meantime, I'd like to have you consider this question. What is most important in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution that is committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence in itself is insufficient without development in vocation. We believe that God works through our vocations, our callings, in order to serve the needs of those around us. The mission statement of Concordia University puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 70 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website, www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and by offering your monetary support. Please consider supporting the Concordia Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on the contribute page. And now, back to the podcast.
Righty there, folks. We are back with our study of Ecclesiastes. And the question now is, what do you do when you're only three verses through the chapter? When you're at the halfway point and you're only three verses through a 29-verse chapter, what do you do? Maybe you figure it out as you go. That's what I'll do. All right, so what are we doing here? Well, boy, I just think, you know, the blessed are those who mourn. There's something... This is just straight out of the New Testament. That's what I just got to conclude with that. This is straight out of the New Testament. And in that sense alone, it's quite profound. I just think that there's so much. Anyway, so we get through these Proverbs, right? That we looked at the first few verses. Again, a lot of this is in line with traditional sayings, but it does kind of, it flips things. It ironizes the whole thing. Like, I'm just kind of looking down the list here. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Well, so here's the deal. Proverbs talks a lot about wisdom, of course, and the wise being able to give counsel and knowing how to reprove the fool and things like that. Okay, now, even the wise, Kohelet says, are susceptible to corruption. Yeah, in a perfect world, Proverbs might be onto something, but hey, there's no part of this world that's free from oppression and bribery, so what are you going to do with that, Proverbs? Because there's a wisdom in recognizing the limitations of wisdom. Yeah, I know. Think about that for a second. And so you kind of look through some of these Proverbs, and this is the sort of thing he does again and again. Oh, here's a good one. Verse 10. Say not, why were the former days better than all the good old days? Boy, it's just nothing like the good old days. Don't think it's not from wisdom that you ask this. Now, what in the world is going on here? Because you yourself, Kohela, talked about wisdom all over the place. You yourself used historical examples. And again, throughout the Bible, I mean, this is the whole Bible, right? Why did the Northern Kingdom fall? 2 Kings 17. It gives you all these lists, right? Well, everything, look at all these past mistakes you've made. If you would have listened to the words of the prophets, if you would have paid attention to the laws and commandments, statutes, decrees, you would have been fine. So learn from your past and don't be like that generation in the wilderness, so to speak. It's Psalm 95. It's all over the place. Learn from the past. Don't ask why the former days were better than these. It's not from, well, then what? Why is that not from wisdom? And there's a sense in which, again, he's kind of flipping things on his head and said there's something to be said for the kind of this mentality, oh, the good old days. Nothing's ever going to be like the good old days. Well, what is the kind of nostalgia that's operating? Is it just kind of a thankful remembrance of what the Lord has done in the past? Or is it more a skepticism of the possibility that there could be any present joy that would equal that of the past? I mean, there's something in present responsibilities. You can add that too, maybe not as pronounced, but the kind of enjoyment and toil that the Lord has given right in front of you. Is it this sort of, you know, the back in the good old days? Are we really saying the back in the good old days thing, again, in light of this sort of thankful remembrance? Or is there some sort of doubt there that the Lord can provide the same sort of goodness that the good old days had in the present time and through the present responsibilities and through the kind of enjoyment that can come in the present work? Especially if we cannot know all the consequences of our present actions, or if we cannot know all of the meaning and the purpose that the Lord has arranged for us in our lot, to use Kohelet's word. This is our lot, to find enjoyment in our toil, knowing that the Lord is behind it in all that we do. It's just a fascinating overlap here in this chapter with Romans 8. I mean, knowing that in all things, for the good, no matter what's going on, the sorrow and the tears and the flippy flops of the Proverbs, that in all things the Lord is still working to accomplish his purposes, working all things for the good of those who love him, as Paul would say in Romans 8. Well, there's this, I think, again, fascinating overlap with how Kohelet is arranging his Proverbs with what we love to confess all the time anyway. Hey, it'll all work out for the good, or however people kind of refer to that. But this is the kind of thing that he does, and just such, if we don't really kind of, you know, think this through, if we just kind of look at it and abstract it and turn it into like a bumper sticker, then just like, well, this guy said some weird stuff and I don't even know why it's in the Bible. And yet, as much as it challenges and presents tensions and things, it's really quite coherent, and it makes just an even better, beautiful harmony with the rest of the choir of sacred scripture. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Again, this is, I mean, it's not like God is absent from all this stuff. Oh, Kohelet's off the rails. But he knows a thing or two. God is very much involved in this. It reminds me of Job when all these bad things happen. Well, what caused it all? I think the instinct is to say, well, Satan did. No, I mean, it was the fire of God. The Lord gives, the Lord takes. The Lord has done everything. He creates light. He forms darkness. He brings calamity. He brings peace. He does everything. Kills, makes alive. Everything, absolutely everything is attributed to him. This is exactly what Kohelet says. This is consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Yeah, it might feel pretty crooked. It might feel like his work is quite alien. Alien is your work, O Lord. Your ways are above us. You might even say, it's just Kohelet's way of speaking like Isaiah. God has made things crooked. Alien is your work, as Isaiah would say. All is enigmatic. But even if that's the case, everything's mysterious. You can't grasp it. You can't get on top of it, control it, so to speak. If it's all a vapor, a breath, the wind that kind of escapes through the fingertips, even if it's you can't get mastery over it, well, still, Kohelet said, God must be the source. So if there's things that are just not quite straight in life, well, God is still the source. If it's enigmatic, if it's kind of obscure, if it's hard to, you can't master it, God is still the source. Who can make straight what he's made crooked? Who can get outside of time in order to see how his time? Who can get outside of our vocation, our work, in order to see what kind of purposes and plans he's working through in the midst of it all, behind it all? None of us. And yet he still attributes... So this is just a very fascinating section. Neither your good rep nor even wise people who are in a broken world, nor vexation, nor discerning why the present is worse than the past, nor thinking about the good old days, nor money, nor anything else, will be able to get you very far in the nature of the good life. Really, biblically speaking, good life. So this is just some profound wisdom. Luther, when I was kind of going through here and there with, you know, what have other people done with this? And of course, Luther has these brilliant little nugs too, and I think he's spot on. And I don't say that just because I'm Luther. I think he's spot on. Although maybe there's a little bit of that there. Okay, but he's spot on when he said, "Prepare yourself." After he got done with this section, sorry, Luther gets done, and this is what he just a couple sentences. Prepare yourself in such a way that you are also able to be sorrowful. Enjoy the things that are present in such a way that you not base your confidence on them. Be happy in such a way that we do not immerse ourselves in present joys. Reserve part of our heart for God so that with it we can bear the day of adversity. There's this kind of royal road, this middle road that the truly wise walk. It's not this sort of like, it's more ontological than economical. What do I mean by that? It's not this sort of scale progression where there's this kind of level of intellect or wisdom and 0 to 10, I hope to be a 10 sort of thing. It's not really that kind of scale at all. It's really how well the middle road is being walked. And to the extent that it is the extent to which one is truly and utterly biblically wise. It's just a fascinating way to think about, you know, we just have such different ideas about how all this works in our secularly dominated frameworks and things like that. Boy, how do you stop this thing? Well, you stop this, the podcast, that is, by reflecting the last part of the... So he goes on here, the rest of the chapter really... Okay, if it's a broken world, how do we approach wisdom and folly? And really, I've already kind of tipped my hat in the direction I want to end here. But you need moderation, because both excessive wisdom and excessive folly will lead to your destruction, basically. Yeah, I mean, Kohelet is saying you don't want to be excessive in either wisdom or folly. That's the fascinating thing about how he concludes this chapter and why it's such a big deal here. This I'm thinking in particular verses 23 to 29. It's kind of like it is another sort of climax or culmination of sorts, a moment of realization. Because all of this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. In other words, his search by wisdom fails to give wisdom. He's recognizing the limitations of wisdom, and there's a wisdom in recognizing them. I know it just sounds like kind of circular reasoning or whatever, but it makes him sound like the person of Job. It's deep, very deep. Who can find it? Sheol says it's not with me. Abaddon, the deep sea, these places, it's not, nor have I heard a rumor of it. It's Job 28, right in the middle of all of his struggles. He says, where can wisdom be found at the end of the day? Because even using wisdom to search out and to be wise, again, searching by wisdom fails to give wisdom. Now, what are you going to do with that? Well, then you're going to conclude like verse 24. It's deep, it's far off, and who can find it out? So there's a kind of humility that comes in to say, I have gone full circle, and the definition of wisdom is much more involved than you'll ever think, because I'm flipping everything, I'm trying everything, and I'm actually coming kind of full circle to a position of humility. It's a very important section here. He ends up concluding, I'm kind of running out of time, so I'll just kind of jump to the end. But he ends up concluding, and it just kind of throws people off guard. Like all of a sudden he concludes there that there's something more bitter than death, and that is the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. Now, what are you talking about, a woman all of a sudden? And then he'll go down there, and one thing in a thousand, but a woman among these I've not found. So all of a sudden he introduces this whole woman thing, and people think, oh, he's depressed because he had a bunch of bad dates, or he never got married, or his wife passed away, or all these different things. But you look at the language he's using here, and of course the fact that Proverbs is up on his radar screen, and the chief examples he's using as he closes the section is very important section for his whole book. The best examples of wickedness and folly come in the form of a romantic relationship. These women. More bitter than death is the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. But then he also talks about a woman among all these, that is the thousand, I have not found. So on the one hand, there's this woman that's net and snares and nasty. There's this other one that's, well, this kind of woman who can find. This is exactly the kind of stuff that you're going to see in Proverbs. This is Dame Folly, the woman that calls out to all the simple fools saying, come after me. She's like it. You get into Proverbs, and the opening of Proverbs, two women are competing for your attention. One is usually referred to as Dame Folly. Her ways are, come, O fools, O simple ones, listen to me. Let's make our fill of love till the morning. She kind of presents herself like a prostitute. And then there's Lady Wisdom. Chapter 8, and you get this sort of, my way, I'll give life and all of the wisdom and you'll inherit the land and all these different things. Qohelet himself is speaking like the opening of Proverbs, and he's admitting that he himself has been seized by Dame Folly. He has fallen prey to her snares and her traps. It's more bitter than death. And he ends by saying, there's really nothing better than Lady Wisdom. God has made man upright, but man has made many schemes. He's got this one man among a thousand I've found, but a woman among all these I have not found. As in Lady Wisdom, in light of all my pursuits, in light of everything I'm able to do, I have not found. And so this, his own search has led him into his own kind of schemes, as the chapter ends. God's made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. He himself, this is like self-directed irony. And he has fallen prey in his search for wisdom to Dame Folly. And he ends by saying, this is just very pivotal for the whole book, he ends by saying, where can true wisdom be found? Well, it's really found in Lady Wisdom. It's really found in the kinds of things that Proverbs has said all along. It's really found, not that I've been wrong about everything and I repudiate it. Again, the journey, the pleasure is in the journey here, and the pleasure also is in how these things look in light of the struggles and the tensions that Qohelet presents. There's a true wisdom in that journey itself. That's the book of Ecclesiastes, the journey itself. Come with me and let's have some fun. And yet he still, it's just a profound way to conclude, just a very different journey than the book of Proverbs, and yet they end at the same place by saying, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And thanks be to God that he has sent wisdom into the flesh in the person and work of his son, Jesus Christ. Whoa, I kind of had to move through, as usual. I always do this, right? You know, run out of time and push through and that sort of thing. It's fascinating stuff, and I'm glad you're with me on this journey of the podcast series through Ecclesiastes. That is, as you can guess, all the time that we have for this session of Christ in Every Word. But I'll tell you what, please consider mentioning this to your family and friends so that they can learn more about God's Word with us. The mission of the Concordia Bible Institute is to provide Christ-centered Bible instruction from distinguished experts who teach Christ in every word of the Old and New Testaments to strengthen faith and spread belief in the one true God. Again, if you benefit from this podcast series, I encourage you to consider supporting the Bible Institute by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and clicking on our contribute page. This Saturday, also very special seminar, Dr. Paul Meyer. You can still register if you're tracking along here. This Saturday, September 24, Dr. Paul Meyer. Don't miss out. It's going to be a great day. Until next time, I'm Dr. Brian Gurman, wishing you God's blessings in Christ Jesus our Lord.